Welcome to today's episode of The Power of Reinvention. Here we talk with my guests about the dreams, the visions, and the passions that individuals have every day and dare to explore them. Whether it's business or personal, you're entitled to live the life that you want, and no matter what the circumstances, you have the power to create success, fulfill your dreams, and live with passion. That's what I'm talking about. So dare greatly and happy reinventing, folks. Hello, everybody. This is Kathy Sharp Ross, and I am thrilled. This is the first podcast of 2024. Not a new season, but my goodness, we are now, mid-January, and I have to just share that I am just coming off an amazing experience last night. I actually was able to have my first ever Barnes & Noble book signing. And some of you are listening to this going, wait a minute, that book's been around for 3 years. How is it that you just did your first book signing? Well, if you do the math, March 7th, 2020 was my pub date. And I couldn't do a book signing because a week after that, we were all sent home. And although I had all kinds of wonderful things planned, I had to reinvent my book launch plan. I had to reinvent my marketing strategy. I jumped into and very quickly pivoted and created the Reinvention Virtual Chats. And then 2 years ago, created the Power of Reinvention podcast. And I've been blessed and fortunate enough to have interviewed hundreds and hundreds of incredible men and women from all walks of life over the last 3 years, but having a real book signing at Barnes & Noble last night was really a watershed moment for me. So I just want to kind of celebrate that and introduce my guest today, Will Lee. Hi, Will.
Hey, Kathy. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Congrats on the book signing. Congrats.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Hopefully the next one will be in New York very soon. So we're working on that.
We'd love to see you here.
Well, thank you. And I so appreciate you being my first guest of the year and just being able to make time in your crazy schedule. So I'm going to give a little background on who Will is for those that don't know you, and then we're going to delve into a fun conversation. Will Lee is the CEO of Adweek, the leading media brand and platform serving the marketing and advertising industry. Prior to Adweek, Will served as chief operating officer of NPR, overseeing strategy, transformation, and growth for the revered news and cultural organization and its network of 249 member stations. Previously, he led the digital business for People, Entertainment Weekly, Sports Illustrated, and The Hollywood Reporter, and has 2 decades of experience in content creation, audience expansion, brand development, and a continuing commitment to and evolution of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Will lives in New York City, and I get to see him whenever I'm in New York or any industry event. We're now constantly seeing each other and running into each other. And I think when we first met, delightfully through the introduction by our friend Bruce Gersh, who you worked with previously, I was really enamored with not only who you are, but the task at hand that you have at Adweek in today's world. And talk about reinventing a business, reinventing an industry. We have so much to unpack in this conversation. But before we go there, I'm going to take you a little bit back in time, Will. And I want to ask you, who was little Will? And when you really sort of started, you know, getting that twinkle in your eye for what you want to do when you grow up, did you have any notion where you'd be, what industry you'd end up in? You know, like what was the world of Will Lee's future when you were growing up?
Well, Kathy, thanks for that introduction and thank you for having me. It's a thrill to be on, and I've listened to many of the shows and really enjoyed them, and they've been very meaningful to me. And I think having been at NPR, one of the real hallmarks of a great show is that you listen to it again, and I have.
I've re-listened
to them, so it's really nice to be on the show. So, little Will, well, if I'm being honest, there was a little bit of if you remember Family Ties, the 80s television show, there was definitely a little Alex P. Keaton in me.
Love that.
From a sartorial perspective, but also I think people would describe me as being a little pre-professional, if you will. And I really, you know, my favorite computer game growing up was Lemonade Stand, which was for the Apple II, and you would, you know, it was all about commerce. And I also, I often tell people, I started reading Adweek when I was 10. And the story is that my mother, who I love dearly, was chronically late to pick me up for after-school activities. So I'd be in the library at the local community college, having taken a class there. And, you know, 10 minutes would stretch into 30, 30 would stretch into an hour. And so I spent a time in the library. And so I would wander over to the stacks where the periodicals were. And because it's Adweek, it was one of the first publications on the stacks. So it'd be right there and I'd pick it up. And if you remember at that time, early to mid 80s was when the advertising industry was really, had really become part of the sort of the cultural zeitgeist in a way I don't think it had before. So if you think about 1984, you think about Wendy's, the Where's the Beef commercials and the FedEx guy. And there was just a tremendous amount of kind of cultural phenomena.
I think a bit of almost pulling back of the curtain where people started to understand that things were created. They didn't just show up.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. There was and creativity. And if you honestly, if you look at some of the really great campaigns of the 80s, they would be pretty groundbreaking today. Right. Mm-hmm. In terms of the way they stretched the form and the way they really spoke to the consumer. So, you know, so I was fascinated. And I didn't really know as a 10, 11 year old that there was a whole world of people who did this. But, you know, I would read about, you know, Charles Saatchi. I would read about Jay Shiat. I would read about these agency, you know, leaders, and they were sort of celebrities to me. And more to the point, and beyond that, I grew up in Central Illinois, and so publications were sort of my window into a world outside. And Adweek specifically was a window into, you know, at that time, New York, right? And I think part of the reason that I ended up in New York and I always wanted to live in New York was, frankly, because I read about Madison Avenue. And so I was just fascinated by it from a very, very young age. I think to get to your question, I don't think I had a notion that I would necessarily be an advertising person or a journalist or a content person. But I did love the sort of the craft of media. And I remember I got my first typewriter when I was about 8 years old. It was like an electric typewriter, made a ton of noise. But I loved putting together, you know, box scores from the sports pages and writing, like, you know, completely made up articles about my favorite sports teams. And so I think I always had that sort of in me as an interest. Yeah. But ultimately as time went by, I was, and I did the, you know, newspapers in high school and college and all that. And, but I don't know that I knew exactly what a career would look like. And part of the reason was that my father, my aunt, my uncle were all dermatologists, and their three other siblings were all engineers or scientists of some kind. So I just thought it was preordained that, you know, the world of work would mean medicine or science or something like that.
With your profound interest in what you were getting interested in, you still thought you'd end up there. That was just something you were interested in.
It's sort of a serious hobby in a way.
But, yeah, exactly.
You know, I didn't have a sense. I had a very clear sense of how doctors made money. I did not have a very clear sense of how people in the media, reporters, made money. But
aren't we still trying to figure some of that out?
I think we are. Yeah, it's in 2024. It's murkier than ever, frankly.
Yeah.
But it's so anyway. So I really I think I've always liked it. And then it turns out, interestingly, that I didn't really make this connection until quite recently. In fact, when I was at NPR, but my great my paternal grandfather was my father's father was the head of the Korean broadcasting system before the Korean War. Right. So he was he ran that agency, and then my maternal grandfather actually owned was a publisher of a newspaper in Seoul, a daily. So it's almost like there was media in my background. I just never really thought about it. And, you know, because it sort of, and in this case, it definitely skipped a generation. So it's been an interesting journey. And if you ask if I thought that this was where I would be, I don't think I had any idea where I would be, right?
Which is delightful. And I'm sure, you know, I don't know how often you reflect on that question, but it is the fun reason why I love, sometimes we don't realize the dots that we subliminally might have been connecting, or that what pulls us. And I talk often about when people say, well, how do I figure out what my passion is when I want to reinvent my life? And I go, just listen to yourself a little more. Just like pull back and say, what makes me happy? What makes me smile? What makes my heart sing? Where are my interests? And why aren't I actually pursuing that as something I could be doing and maybe turn into a business, a career, a job? So, you know, sometimes it's interesting to see where the thread is from something that you were interested in as a young person and where we are today. And it's always fun, you know, it's like, oh, I wanted to be a ballerina. Well, you know, truly, like, what are the odds of becoming a ballerina at this point in my life? Not going to happen. Doesn't mean I can't go watch the ballet more often or buy season tickets or do things that at least keep the connection in our lives.
Sure.
But I think from a career standpoint, it's really incredible to see that evolution. So what would have been that pivotal moment where you started to lean into the career path that has gotten you here? Like, what was that aha moment for you?
It's good. It's, you know, I think, and I love the themes that you talk about on the show when it comes to reinvention, and really sort of almost that sort of self-awareness that has to be part of the reinvention journey. So I think my reinvention journey, in many respects, the aha moments were about understanding and recognizing and just being very honest with myself about the things that I wasn't very good at. And where, you know, I had thought maybe I would go in a certain direction for reasons that, you know, might not have been particularly honest, but I just decided I wanted to do something because it was a job that I felt like I could you know, make money doing. But I think at several points in my career, I realized, for instance, when I left college, I went to work at a small investment boutique, and I realized that I had friends who were, you know, a couple of years older than I was, who were running hedge funds, right? And I just wasn't going to be that good. And as a result, I had to you know, pivot away from that, right? Quickly, right? But that recognition was really important for me. And then subsequently, I started more on the writing track. So, like many graduates of liberal arts colleges in the Northeast, you know, you have these aspirations of being the next, you know, John Cheever, or you know, being a magazine writer for the New Yorker or the Atlantic or Harper's. And again, I didn't then took an assistantship at Entertainment Weekly. And what I realized there was there were people who were at the same level I was, assistants, who even then you could see were going to be really successful writers. And I'll just use a few examples by name.
Yeah, I'd love to hear.
You know, the person who had my job before me as the assistant to the News and Notes editor was a woman named Anna Holmes, who started Jezebel. And she, you know, became a content executive for the Obamas. Incredibly talented writer, incredibly talented voice. A guy named Troy Patterson, who was a staff writer for The New Yorker, right? He was a critic for Slate. And then, you know, sort of late in my tenure there, a woman by the name of Gillian Flynn, showed up to be an editorial assistant. And of course, she went on to write Gone Girl and many other books. And so when you see those people, and I think it's not a gift exactly, but I was fortunate enough to recognize their talent. And I could just, I just knew that that wasn't me. On the other hand, I think I knew that the business side of content, the business side of media was something that I just had more aptitude for than some of my colleagues, right?
Right.
And so I recognized that. And over time, after going to business school at NYU, you know, I sort of fell more into the operating side, the business side of content. And so I, so there's this notion of understanding your kind of place, no matter how much you want to do something, you know, follow your passion is fine. And I really admire people who follow their passion and actually make it work. In my case, I think I followed the path of what I felt like I was going to be really good at. And that has become my passion.
Which is extraordinary. And I just, you know, sort of just love how and what you exactly said right there. It is extraordinary when you get to create a career out of something that you enjoy and realize that it is your passion. What's really funny is you were saying all that, I thought, I think one day you might actually get to write a book about how you built or did your, you know, and sort of grew your career and your passion. So you may end up becoming that writer one day in a different way. And that's what's really fun. And I think that is the fun of a reinvention conversation. I speak so much to people from all different walks of life who are trying to understand when and where and how they may pivot some part of their life. And there are no boundaries. There are no borders. The ability to take something that you love and tweak it or recognize that you're at a phase in your life where now it is safe to explore something or to dabble in something else. And, you know, it doesn't have to be, like I said, okay, maybe I'm not going to ever become that ballerina that I wanted to be when I was 8 years old, but I can enjoy something about it. I'm now sitting on the board of Body Traffic, one of the most profound dance companies in the country, that is giving me a place to nurture what's in my love and soul and passion for the art of dance. It's not ballet, it's contemporary, but it's giving it a place in my life to have that joy. And, you know, maybe there will be another chapter per se, where you do get to tell that story and it does become a writing exercise. And even if it's not A to Z writing a book, it could be a contributing writer. It could be articles, and maybe it's not. Maybe it's just, you know, that ship has sailed and there's going to be something else. But it's wonderful when we can find the things that we love and enjoy doing them and really dig into them. The industry's changed a lot. Since, you know, you and I both started out, I think I probably started out a little bit earlier than you did. but it has reinvented. And we saw recently at CES last week, the notion and one of the companies called it the reinvention of marketing, which I loved because I love seeing people use my word. I call it my word. And we've seen a lot of changes, the evolution, technology's played a role in it. Self-publishing has played a role in it. The content creation and the creator culture has played a role in it. Brands, and you said something earlier about when you were reading Adweek and the advent of the industry and people really recognizing the pop cultural zeitgeist that suddenly advertising started to really proliferate in our industry. I remember, you know, we used to look at companies. We just didn't call them brands. Now we call them brands. We've always been doing strategic partnerships with content and personalities, but now we put a label around it and it's called something, but it's not like it wasn't being done back in the day. But we've seen a huge shift in the way we're consuming content, the way we're creating content, the way brands are spending money to connect with consumers. Let's talk a little bit about, from your perspective, sitting where you do, seeing what you do with all the players across all of these verticals, where do you think the most profound shift has happened and any sort of purview that our industry is talking about as far as where it's going or what's the next aha moment in our industry.
So I'll take you back. You know, so I've been in the role at Adweek for about 5 months now, and so and I am an infant, to be honest, in sort of the advertising and marketing world, because I came up really through the sell side, through publishing, and I'm learning a lot. And I think I've people like you and many others have been very generous with advice and frankly just information transfer. So I've been very grateful to have this role and to learn more about it. But I think, you know, one of the more profound things that is happening when you talk about brands is this shift that's happening around, you know, the media company, right? As sort of imagined how many ever decades ago, is really sort of, I'm going to say, dissolving and evolving into brands that are driven by human beings. So if you think about the creator economy is the most obvious example. But even in the media business, you look at a business like Puck, right, or mm-hmm. Axios, and you see the individual human beings becoming brands of their own, right? And it's not a new concept. Obviously, we've had columnists for as long as media has existed, and those voices have been really important. But I think what's really interesting to me is to see this shift in media companies that, I mean, you just look at the last, you know, year alone. You've seen essentially the impending demise of brands that were started in 2007, 2008, like BuzzFeed and Vice, that were so hot, and those brands were really hot, right? But now we're talking about people who write Substacks and people who have a million followers on TikTok or even not even a million, be really, really important parts of their respective, you know, vertical ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, to me, from where I've come from, and I've worked for some of the greatest brands in all of media, you know, and I've been really lucky to, but that has changed massively. And I think that just signals a change in how, you know, this ecosystem will look, right? Because it's not just about, you know, massive scale in terms of how you reach the consumer. It's about engagement. And I think, you know, one thing that I'm grateful for in publishing is that we're not all just going to be enslaved to Google,
right?
You know, and enslaved to the whims of, you know, what was then Facebook, what is now Meta, right? Where constantly you were having, because you wanted people to come to your website or to your digital property, you just had to go out and be essentially a marionette for the platforms. And now I think we're getting to a place, when I think about Adweek and sort of the reinvention of what we're doing here, where you can have much more engaged and really intentional and, you know, very much more almost seemingly one-to-one relationships with the audience. So that's really from my standpoint. I do think, you know, in terms of sort of how things are evolving, you know, I do think this is a critical year for the advertising and marketing world, because, you know, I had the CMO of a very large, very, very large technology company tell me recently that, you know, she thought that the remit of the marketer is murkier than it ever has been. And part of that, I think, is that, you know, CEOs and CFOs with so much financial pressure have found it difficult to, you know, support the efforts of their CMOs. But equally, on the CMO side, there, I think there's a moment now to really reemphasize the importance of the things that they do, right? Driving audience, acquiring, engaging, converting audience and customers, and really, you know, surfacing that insight to their CEO and CFO. And one of the things that I say about Adweek is that if we do our job right and at this moment in the marketing and advertising world, we should be as widely read by CEOs and CFOs, chief operating officers, as we are by the rest of the C-suite and marketers and agencies. So I think that's a very long way of saying, I think there's a real opportunity here to help transform and, if you will, reinvent the practice that we've covered and chronicled for many years.
Yeah, and I really enjoy what you just said about the importance of the full C-suite reading and knowing and tapping into Adweek. And I think it is such an important part of both business and pop culture and the zeitgeist that defines where we're going. It also really holds up the creativity that is happening. And I think when a CEO of a company is exposed to the creativity that is happening in partnerships, I mean, I am in the partnership business. That's what the Sharp Alliance does. Bringing two brands or three brands together to play, to create, to cross reference each other's audiences and data and really sort of leverage a little more of what each other are doing. That's when in our equation, in our language, in this agency, we say 2 + 2 = 100, not 4. And when CEOs are exposed to that thinking, because that's what their CMOs or their agencies are doing for them or with them, that's an important perspective for them to understand while on parallel paths, of course, keeping an eye on the bottom line, the growth of the business. And I think the role of the CMO, which I know has been so debated in the last couple of years, the term of a CMO and the role of a CMO, and now with data and technology, you know, the pressure, frankly, on a CMO has to be shared a little bit more across these different C-suite executives, because it is daunting. It is overwhelming. We are consuming so much information. Things are moving at the speed of light on a daily basis. Keeping up with it, let alone adapting it, is a big task. And, you know, I think there's got to be a lot of accountability in that C-suite from the top down, for everybody to be involved and have impact and influence and make smart decisions. And it's really interesting because I think coming out of the pandemic, where we saw for the first time, and I'm curious to know if you think it's gone away a bit, the need or the ability to pivot so quickly because there was no room for experimentation or testing. It was like, oh my God, we are at this moment. Everybody went into panic mode. We've got to pivot. We've got to shift. We've got to do something because we are in year 1, month 6 of the pandemic, and we've got a company to run. There is no room for testing theories and analyzing data. We got to like just pivot and hope to God that it sticks. Do you think the companies and agencies and C-suite executives learned what's possible from that moment and are kind of adopting a little bit more of that renegade strategy? Or has everybody gone back to that safe, let's take 6 months, a year, 2 years to test and figure it out?
That's a very interesting question, Kathy. I think there are definitely a lot of companies, whether it's on the brand side or the agency side, that where the DNA almost like had to be, it just had to be remixed and I think changed considerably. And I think some of those companies certainly have adapted to it. I would say that there's as we come out of COVID, and I think, you know, largely we are, or it's something that we just live with. I think there's
That to anybody that was at CES.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. Not. Yeah, exactly. No, I think there are some companies that still that look back pre 2020 and say, I wish we could just do it that way. And I wish we could, you know, if you see it in sort of return to office, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm a big proponent of being in office, but I think some of the narrative around that has actually started to sound like, oh well, you know, it was better before, right? And I think that I do think that you know, there are companies that I don't want to say they're regressing, but they're sort of reverting to old habits. And you know, I think certain examples would be not anyone in particular, but I think you see companies trying to not properly sort of evolving their business model and struggling to. I can think of a couple media companies now, and again, this is my main point of reference, but a couple media companies that are still really trying to, you know, juice Google and referral sources as much as possible and not thinking of, because they've built their entire company on that premise. And, you know, this is the year that generative AI and large language models are going to completely disrupt that. And anybody who believes that, you know, search, while it still will exist, it's going to exist in a completely different way. And so I just think that, There's a variety of ways to go about it, but I think it's hard, and I'm not sure that a lot of I would say slightly maybe contrarian take. I think a lot more companies are kind of again reverting rather than like moving and really changing their DNA.
Yeah, no, it's such a fascinating topic. I mean, you know, I've run an agency for 35 years and I've always sort of acted on the premise of if you test things too much, you're coming from a place of not believing that they can actually work as opposed to let's do this with intention. Let's leave no room for failure or doubt or, you know, just that not working mentality. We're going to make this happen. We're going to create it. And I loved what I saw happen during the pandemic because I saw companies just be bold, make decisions and pivot and put everything into it to create success.
Right.
As opposed to let's sit back and cross our arms and go, it may work. It may not. You know, let this prove me right that it's not going to work. Mentality, which may sound very psychological, but I think it's the way we see a lot of companies practice. Now, I have never lived in the walls of a corporate big company, so I get the liberty of building and creating with a little more frivolity for and with our clients. And they're all, you know, great big Fortune 500 type companies and brands and events and programs. But I love that I can come at it with a different attitude because I'm not on the inside and say, look, you know, we've got a place. What I saw happen during the COVID period of that sort of activity got me excited. And I was hoping that we'd see that linger a little bit more, that people would learn how to do things with a little more intentionality and creativity because they had to out of necessity. And that's very much the way I approach a lot of what we do in business with our clients. And it's going to be interesting. And you said the magic word, AI. I mean, who's not having a conversation about where and how that fits into everything that we're doing and where we're going with it? Can we talk a moment about sort of what you're hearing and seeing in that world?
Sure. And I just want to make a kind of addendum to your point, which is that, you know, under the rubric of never let a good crisis go to waste, right? I think there's what has to happen is that I don't want to say it's necessarily going to be more crisis and crisis modes coming, but the way the world and the dynamism of our society today, you know, writ large, political, socioeconomic, is such that, you know, just like the weather is today, the undulations, the wavelength and amplitude of change is going to be so much more drastic, right? And I think we just have to get used to a time where you are going to have to gird yourself for those things and you have to build an organization that where people are resilient, right? And the human beings are as tenacious and resilient and that will make the business more so, right? And I often tell my teams that you know, tenacity is one of the three most important things that I look for in people, right? Because it's particularly in the media world that I've inhabited, every year is a different problem. And I think, you know, I was really happy with some of the work we did at NPR during a very difficult time for sponsorship, and we were able to, I think, you know, I left before a lot of the changes that we started to build actually took fruit, but you're going to see NPR start to look very different, I think, than it has. And that's an organization that is beloved, but quite frankly, you know, over the course of its first sort of 45, 50 years, hadn't been all that responsive to change. Now, it evolved into a much more digitally forward podcasting kind of model, but there's a lot about it that was still sort of beholden to its past. And I think, you know, I think one of the things that I love doing in companies is sort of creating that framework and the DNA, right? The genetic material to really changing the metabolic rate to make companies and the humans who are part of them more responsive to crisis and to change. Just again, now get to AI. I think that's very much part and parcel of what I just said, which is that, you know, I think this might be a slightly controversial take, I'm not sure, but I think a lot of company has spent a lot of time scratching their chins and sort of, you know, gazing at AI like, all right, what are we going to do with it? Like it's, you know, some foreign object, you know, placed in front of them. And I think that's a mistake. I think, you know, as you said, you just have to get in there and use it, right?
Yeah.
And you have to understand how it can augment your business. And I think while it's fine to have like a policy around how you use AI, like a lot of news organizations have, or sets ground rules for the staff as to what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable,
right.
You know, policy is fine, right? And that, you know, that can have a lot of use, but it's just about, you know, usage. Like I try to use 3-4 different kinds of language models and GPTs, you know, every week. And anytime I hear about a new one, I'll try another one because it's a tool for us.
Yeah.
All of us, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it basic things like sort of, you know, writing job descriptions. You know, one of the things, you're a writer, so you know this.
Yep, yep.
One of the hardest things to do as a writer is to start, right? I used to do this thing, I remember when I was, you know, a young magazine writer and I would just get stuck. It was always because I couldn't find the right word for something, right?
Yeah.
So I had spent a lot of time, like the thesaurus was my best friend. Now, it might not be the best thing to do, you know, from a writing standpoint, but it just helped me get started.
But it sparks something. I love that you just said that. And I, you know, it's fascinating because I'm actually empowering my team. I want them to, everybody needs to be relevant. So yep. You've got to know responsibly how to use it, when to use it, why to use it. Look, there was a time where, you know, typing on a computer or using a calculator was like, what, cheating? A shortcut? Like, why not use the tools responsibly in a way that are going to enhance and create more productivity? We use ChatGPT or AI, you know, any of these platforms for a number of reasons. I mean, look, I told you I did my book signing event last night. So walking my dog over the weekend, I thought, okay, I need to do like a 10-minute opening when I do my book signing event on Wednesday night. And I dictated it into my phone. And then I thought, wow, I'm going to transcribe it. And then I'm going to have ChatGPT come up with an outline for me. Why would I ask one of my staff members to spend 1 or 2 hours of their day when they have much more important things to do a task like that? And yet there are things that I do tell them to use it for, to save their time, but also because I want them to learn. I want them to learn when to use it, when not to use it, how to be responsible with it. But more importantly, just like I do when someone hands me a document that they've written, I'm now going to look at it, read it, and make the appropriate edits. Mm-hmm. Because there are things as humans that we know who is that audience in that room, the subtle nuance of emotion or humor or something that we need to connect and communicate. So, you know, I think we've got to figure out, and we're all in that formative stage, and I think there are much bigger business issues and goals as to where and how and when.
Sure.
But, you know, pretending it doesn't exist or poo-pooing it because we're just afraid that it's going to overtake our lives is not the solution. Knowledge is power. I mean, I remember when, you'd buy the new VCR and I was the one that was like, I'm going to read the manual before I plug it in so that when I plug it in, I know what buttons to push and I'm not going to be afraid of the machine. I am going to control it. And it's kind of the same thing here. Like we've got to arm ourselves with the knowledge to have the power over it or with it.
I love that. In fact, I grew up in a household where my father would not let us operate anything, including, I remember, our first microwave oven until we had all read the manual, the operating manual.
I love it. Okay, good. So, my kindred spirit. I've never met anybody who has said that. And, it wasn't cover to cover, but it was the highlights or the user's guide or something. So that you weren't afraid of it. We've done a lot of partnerships with retail malls, and there was a deal that we did with a consumer electronics brand years ago, and we put them in about 17 of their malls. And the whole premise was, come get familiar with this piece of equipment. If you know it, you will want it, you will buy it, you will use it. If you're not afraid of it, you can find a way to include it in your life. So I think it's very much like that.
Yeah, I think there's and look, I think the if you think about what's going to happen this year, one of the devices that got a lot of attention was this the Rabbit R1 device.
Yes,
essentially multimodal AI device, and I think what struck me about seeing that keynote and thinking about that device is not necessarily, would I buy one or would I not buy one? I haven't yet, but I would. What I think about it is, if you think about the multimodality, right? Sort of, being able to get you an Uber or being able to, take a picture of your fridge and ask for a recipe. We are going to have to get much better at that, right? Quickly. Because the technology will surpass us and will always move faster than we do. But all this hand-wringing about about how it will destroy society, that's up to us. Like humans can make that happen by learning how to harness these tools. And so I think it's something, for my team, I like to my exec team, I like to give them sort of second majors, as it were, right? Some other things that they can spend some time on. And my second major, I told them, is AI, right? Because it's not necessarily just from a corporate perspective or from an enterprise perspective. It's really from a self, sort of self-enrichment perspective. So I'm really excited. I'm very bullish. And I think the advertising and marketing industries are going to benefit tremendously. I mean, I just spoke to an agency president who told me about using a AI-driven, a large language model-driven focus group, right? That created, a huge amount of actual personas, right? Individual personas that, you could run creative by and you could get effectively get a panel for instant reaction and instant feedback, but without having and without having to pay them,
right?
Except for the software, and that's the kind of thing that it's super fascinating. And I think that there's so many use cases like that. If you kind of look down the road, it is going to be a tremendous game changer for all industries, but certainly for advertising and marketing. We want to be Adweek, selfishly, I want to be at the forefront of informing the industry about how all those tools are going to help, as opposed to taking the position of fear.
Right. Well, and brilliantly said right there. I mean, it is, it's getting around that. I talk a lot about fear in the world of reinvention because that ability to reinvent, whether it's an industry, a brand, something on a personal level, fear so often comes up for people. They're in their comfort zone. They know what they know. I'll never forget, I was sitting at a dinner with Gary Vee about 4 years ago. It was right before CES. It was kind of one of his great dinners, and there were probably 20 of us at the table, and it was this wonderful conversation at the time about the impact and the power of social media and where it's going. And maybe it was like 5 years ago, actually. And I remember raising my hand instead of saying, you know what, Gary, it just really bothers me that all these kids and all of us adults walking around with our heads buried in our phones 24/7, we're not looking each other in the eye, we're not talking. And he looked at me and he said, too bad, get used to it. This is the future, get on board. And I thought, how obnoxious. No, but it's that. It's like, we can bury our head in the sand and not like it, or we can lean into it, get comfortable with it, and find a way to make it work for us, with us, in our worlds, in our businesses, in our industries, and embrace it in a way that we get to control it. It doesn't control us. And that's the power. That is really the power right there. I want to pivot for a second with Adweek and the events that you're doing. You're kind of, you know, if I dare to say, you're kind of reinventing the way you're doing events. You want to talk a little bit about sort of like what you're trying to do differently that's going to help pull some of the industry to look at what you're doing in a different way?
Sure. I think we've had great success over the years with Adweek events, and I think they've been an important part of sort of industry connection and informing and bringing intelligence to the industry. But it's gotten a lot more crowded, as you know, Kathy. There's a lot more in the last 4 or 5 years. There's just many more things for our world and people in our world to go to. And so I think this is the moment for us to really reinvent what it means to go to an Adweek event. And I think there are big things and there are small things. I think that, you know, we believe that one of my mantras for the team is fewer things better. And I think that applies to our product mix as well, you know, because I think for us to become the most essential media resource for all of advertising and marketing, we do have to provide value, but you can't try to do everything for everybody, right?
Yeah.
And I think one of the critical things for us is really to think about our event portfolio. And, you know, if we have to do fewer events, but we can make them bigger, we can make them more meaningful. That's sort of the I think that will help people because, you know, again, nobody has time to go to everything, and you have to make the things that they pay for and spend, you know, as you know, like, you know, two or three days away from your office, from your family, from your home. It's a very big investment of time. So if we're asking people to do that, it has to be really worth it. I do think that there are things on the ground that we can continue to do better. For instance, you know, it is somewhat sometimes the quiet part said out loud, but the other people that you see and the interactions that you have are so much part of the value of those gatherings. But what would it mean for us to make those interactions more like really intentional and productive, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of just exchanging phone numbers and having a nice cordial coffee, what does it mean for us to get people of that caliber together and really solve problems and think about things in a way that they haven't before and get different perspectives, you know, so that it's not just sitting and watching people on stage, but it's in fact, you are using some of that time to actually, you know, solve some of your own business problems as well as someone else's. So I think there's going to be a lot more of that. And you're also going to see, I think, us do really focus on outcomes and measurement, right? From a programming perspective, because we want to be the brand in this world that people can rely on for, you know, sort of the core information that they can go to their colleagues and say, this is why this worked, or this is why this didn't work, right?
Yeah.
And you can only do that with real numbers and real outcomes. And I think we have to, I just keep saying, we just kind of have to get nerdier about how we how we talk about these things, because I think there's some of these conferences can be, you know, I think you'd agree, kind of mindlessly celebratory, right? Yeah. And we're all just patting ourselves on the back for things that we've done. And I think we need to take a sharper and, frankly, more numbers driven look at what we say when we mean something is successful or something was not successful.
No, I love that. And as someone who sits in the seat I sit in every day, that is constantly questioning, how do we collaborate better with brands and companies and create the partnerships and relationships we want? And then we go to these conferences, and to your point, you know, and everybody that knows me, it's like, I don't want to sit and just listen to people talk. I can get that on the internet. I can hear the takeaway anywhere, anytime. It's the connections. It is the moment of sparking an idea. It's like, hey, I heard you say this, and I know someone that would be great for that. And imagine if we could create this magic together. But then also to quantify it, to come back to me and say, hey, you spent X amount of dollars to be there, to engage. You spent 3 days away, to your point, from your office, your business, your people, your family, what have you. How impactful was it? How many deals did you really create? How many partnerships will you generate off this? Like, quantifying the value proposition that's going to make all of us think more deliberately. I mean, I know people that go to conferences that have no idea how to work a room, and they don't walk around with business cards anymore. I mean, you know, I feel like I'm giving people a party favor. Let me tell you something, as a PR marketing person who's been building brands for 30 years, you hand someone your business card, guess where it's sitting? Right here on my desk while I'm talking to you, and I'm going to go, oh, I met this guy and we talked about X, and I remember him because I remember the card. Like, personal brand, business brand, conversation, connection. These are things that really matter. Yep. And this whole notion of, oh, I got you in my phone. Guess what? I have 14,000 people in my database in my phone. Do you really think I'm going to remember who I met last Tuesday at a party when we swapped digital information? Like, you know, it may be old school, but there's something to be said for intentional connection and actually trying to do something with it. So the fact that you're thinking about what you're creating with that intentionality, and those outcomes right there says a lot, because it's not just about who's in the room.
Kathy, I've seen you work rooms, and you have a lot to teach me.
Shamelessly.
It's a real skill. And I think I often look at, you know, when people are like standing in a line for lunch at one of these things, and it's like, they should be. And, you know, I'm the one, you know, if we're hosting the event, that's trying to like introduce people who might not have met each other. And I think, you know, we're trying to think of creative ways to almost gamify some of that, right?
Exactly.
So that you're actually getting that value. I'd say the last thing about the events is just that we want to tie what we're doing on the event side very much more tightly with what we're doing on the content side, so that the continuum of the Adweek experience going from an event to our newsletters, to our social, and then in the communities that we're building, like Marketing Vanguard, Jenny Rooney's platform, that needs to be much more tight and much more integrated. And you know, fortunately, we just hired a new chief content officer, Zoe Ruderman. We'll be working with Jenny. And so I think you'll see a lot more of that sort of integration going forward.
Very exciting. Well, I'm excited for you in the next chapter and the, quote, reinvention of all things Adweek. Sort of a almost last question, unfortunately, because we're almost at time. But do you feel like you're living your North Star right now? It feels like it from what I'm hearing. I feel a lot of excitement in your voice with all that's upon you. Is this feeling like your North Star at the moment?
Yeah, there's sort of a glib answer to this, and then I'll give you a more spiritual one. You know, I tell people, I did a dinner for about 20 plus agency presidents my first month at Adweek. And I told them there that when I got to New York, I had this terrible job in finance my first year. And then I actually ended up, before I got the job at Entertainment Weekly as an assistant, I applied to 31 ad agencies. I got 2 interviews and I got 0 offers.
Wow.
And you know, I really wanted to, explore advertising, as a discipline. And I was always fascinated by it, you know, again, starting reading Adweek very young. And I just, you know, it just felt like that was a sign, right? Like, okay, well, move on, like, to the next thing. And ultimately, so if you talk about True North, I do feel like there is some full circle nature here where yeah. I have been able to come back into this industry and frankly, get to know some people who I've admired, whose work is I've admired over the years tremendously. And I'm so excited. I get excited every day just being able to do that. And then I think in terms of the overall sort of the reinvention part of this, that's I think my sort of true north, if you will, is the challenge of reinventing. I've done it, you know, at People, which was a brand that was sorely in need of digital transformation when I got there. Same thing with The Hollywood Reporter. And prior to that, you know, and then at NPR as well, right? So yeah. I think that has become sort of my true north professionally. And, you know, on a personal level, I have I got married sort of late in life and had a child two and a half years ago. And, you know, as many people say about children, it sort of clarifies
right.
Many things about your direction in life. And right. I'd say that you know, having Troy in my life now and that part of my life has really clarified things, and I now can really prioritize the things that deprioritize the things that just aren't important and don't contribute to that true north. So I appreciate the question because I've been thinking about it a lot.
I love that. And thank you for your very honest answer to that, because you know that, and you're right, a child will ground us in no way we've ever understood, the clarity, mm-hmm. the priorities. And it's interesting, the parallel path you're on when you think of Adweek being a part of your life as long as it has,
mm-hmm.
that you are getting to be at the reins of affecting change and creating that pivot for not only the company, but also what that will have a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully on the industry as well, and the way people are connecting and communicating and mm-hmm. creating and feeling accountable for what they're doing in their roles. And you get to sit in the center of all of that. And that is really special. And I'm excited for you. I'm excited
Thank
to see
you.
What's to come. I'm excited to be a part of the journey with all of you and, you know,
Very
love
so.
Jenny and what she's doing. And yeah. she was on the show right before the
yes.
holidays as well.
It was great.
And, you know, I know we're going to continue having these conversations offline because that's where it all started for us. One more really fun question, and you talked about mm-hmm. a dinner party, but we're going to kind of expand beyond the industry. If you could have a dinner party and have mm-hmm. anybody at that table, living or not, that really you felt maybe affected you over the years, maybe a mentor, just that you would love to meet, you know, from any walk mm-hmm. of life, who might be 3 or 4 of those people?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned him earlier, but my paternal grandfather, he passed away before I was born. But you know, when I think about a dinner party, I think you have to have people who are, you know, great raconteurs and people who have, you know, who are sort of verbally skilled, right, to make it, and you know, have great sense of humor. And I'm told that he could really command a table. Right. So I just want to know what that was like. Right. I'd also, you know, I have to say, having spent some time in England during high school and graduate school, the British take, you know, sort of dinner party conversation and dinner party yeah. presence to a very different level. And so yes. I feel like you need maybe a couple Brits in there. And I'm thinking, I'm thinking about, you know, someone like the great author Martin Amis, who passed away recently. I'm a great fan of his books. And then someone like, you know, just using this example, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, right, who is an incredibly funny and unexpected sort of, you know, human being, just, you know, generally not even in her work. And then I'd say, you know, you probably want, if it's going to be a great dinner party, and I'm pretty obsessed with food, you want a good chef.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So
your chef of choice.
I'm thinking of, and this is a very random thing, just because I happen to have eaten at her restaurant, but there's a woman running an incredible contemporary Korean restaurant called Parachute in Chicago. Her name's Beverly Kim, and she's just fascinating story. And I don't know her very well, but she, you know, or any number of chefs that I know, but she would be someone, at least, you know, certainly on the food side, and you know, somebody
I think maybe we need to bring her into the next Ad Week event in some.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah, we're doing one in Chicago. One in Chicago. So shout out to Parachute.
I love that. Oh, this is so fun, Will. You and I just have so much more to talk about, and I'm glad that we'll continue to do this offline. I'm so grateful for your time and having you provide such incredible insights and perspective on the conversation today. Thank you. Thank you for being my guest.
It's been a pleasure.
Any last thoughts that
Thanks,
you
Kathy.
Want to leave the, any last thoughts you want to leave the audience with?
Well, I think, you know, your theme is one I would just reiterate, because I think that you know we are constantly reinventing ourselves, right?
Yes.
None of us are just a purely organic construct, right? How we show up in the world is very much a creation of our own, right? And when you reinvent yourself, I think you also have to think about that part of it, like how you do show up and how you, the essentially the brand you are trying to build. And I tell younger people all the time, people who I mentor, that you have to think about yourself in that way and not just present yourself as though you're just, you know, you have some sort of absolute value.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you are who you make yourself. And so I think that's really important. I think I've heard this sort of theme in a lot of your podcasts, but I think that's such an important takeaway for so many people.
Well, thank you. That is an absolute drop mic moment. So on that note, thank you again for being here
Thanks,
today,
Kathy.
Will.
Been a pleasure.
For those listening, please feel free to check the show notes, how to connect with Will. Of course, all that Ad Week is doing for those of us who are involved in this industry, it's going to be so fun to watch the journey as you reinvent and pivot and all the new things to come. And I'm excited, as everybody else is, to see where you go. Please go to the reinventionexchange.com for blogs and more content and podcasts and everything that we do to inspire and motivate some part of your life. Pick up a copy of the book, which is Reinvent Your Life. What are you waiting for? The foreword was written by Quincy Jones, which was such an honor for me, and has interviews with an incredible number of people. So thank you again, everybody, for joining us. Have a wonderful 2024. Will, thanks for being my first podcast of the year. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening to The Power of Reinvention. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and review the show. Wouldn't mind a 5-star review. It would be greatly appreciated. Also, be sure to visit thereinventionexchange.com to share your reinvention stories, suggest a guest, join the newsletter mailing list, get access to my book, which is called Reinvent Your Life, What Are You Waiting For?, and discover fantastic bonus content with my blogs, and listen in to the Reinvention Virtual Chat Series. Don't forget to join me next week for another episode. Please share with a friend, and thank you for listening. Happy reinventing.